This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Health News Digest on the bigger picture. BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Health News Digest. I'm Tina Camilla, joined by Tisha Ik and Julie Jacobs.
Good afternoon.
Hello. All right, today our theme is Read the Fine Print. We're going to start with the first story on a popular malt beverage. I think we all know what we're referring to.
And in the second feature, we're looking at a case in Johor where a baby died due to asphyxia after the head was stuck in the mother's perineum during a breech delivery that took place at home.
And finally, we'll be looking at the Alzheimer's blood test. So scientists in Japan and Australia have apparently developed a blood test that can actually help detect the buildup of toxic proteins linked to Alzheimer's disease. So while the test is still at its early stage, it's claimed to be an important step towards a blood test for dementia, which is something that I was very excited about when I read it, because the thought of having Alzheimer's scares me to death. But yeah, so we'll talk about that a little bit more after this.
And to lead us into the hour, here is a throwback from the Archies with Sugar Sugar, BFM 89.9. Sugar. Oh, honey, honey. My candy girl, and you got me wanting you, honey. Oh, sugar, sugar. Welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest. I'm Tina Camilla, joined by Tisha Ik and Julie Jacobs. We're going to jump straight into our first story on Milo. A viral video on social media has taken the popular malt beverage to task for its sugar level. In the video, entrepreneur Vishen Lakhiani criticized Milo for claiming to be a healthy beverage, but it actually contains 40 grams of sugar per 100 gram serving.
So what he did in the video was he read the nutrition label where you are supposed to declare the total amount of sugars. Nutrition labels have to declare their nutrients per 100 gram and then per recommended serving size. Going by the very simplistic way that he approached it, if you take the tin to be 100 gram, like 40% of it contains sugar, and that's what he claimed. But later, Nestle came out to clarify that, first of all, don't look at the per 100 gram serving to see how much you're getting in. You have to look at the recommended serving size. And what they recommend is to use 5 teaspoons of the powder dissolved in 200 mils of hot water. So then they say that that serving size will only contain 6% of sugar. How that works out is 5 teaspoons is 30 grams of powder. So 12 grams of sugar is contained in that serving. And 12 grams of sugar in a 200 ml beverage works out to 6%. And they also clarified that the sugar in the drink comes from naturally occurring sources, the extract of malt and the milk, as well as the added table sugar.
Did you check the math?
Is I did, correct? Yes. I actually did this math.
Oh, okay, wonderful.
Well done.
Well done. And it's accurate, yes?
Because, don't trust everything you see on social media, right?
Of course, of course. Anyway, I don't drink... Well, actually, I used to drink Milo. I grew up drinking it because I wouldn't drink milk. Mm. And my parents were worried that I'm not going to grow. Mm. So they added the milk into the Milo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think a lot of parents did that.
So I guess from this whole thing, the only thing that surprises me is the reaction of everybody. I mean, like, surely you have enough common sense to read the nutrition label and to see the content of sugar in it. Surely you are reading what you're feeding yourself and your children. I mean, this is nothing. This is not news. This is nothing that's been hidden. It's so, I've been seeing on social media all these parents saying, oh my God, Milo is bad for you. Hello. This is nothing new.
The way they reacted was as if there was this huge conspiracy to deceive everyone.
Yes.
And then I started reflecting, maybe we are just the type of people to read the labels.
Right.
And that the average person wouldn't.
For sure, yeah, and I think you're right, because I remember very clearly I never used to read the nutrition labels either until I wanted to lose weight, because I was obese. I was like over 80 kilos and I wanted to lose weight. And the first advice that they give you is read your nutrition labels. Things that are called healthy often contain a lot of sugar or a lot of different ingredients which are, you know, quietly making you fatter, is essentially what they were trying to say. Mm-hmm. Even things like cereal, for example, even things like energy bars or all those sorts of things which you think, oh, it's got grains, it must be healthy for me, but you're not actually reading how much sugar goes in to make it taste good, right? If you're on social media, if you're using the internet, like I think everyone, surely you've come across articles telling you read the nutrition label.
I love how riled up you are.
I am, because it's just like all these people are capitalizing on this sudden, like, oh, Milo is bad. Okay, go look at all the different nutrition labels of all the foods that you're feeding your children. Vitagen, for example, contains sugar as well. It's not some health drink. Mm-hmm. Half the soy drinks or whatever it is that you're feeding yourself and your children, all of it contains sugar. You're not supposed to eat the powder straight from the tin. You're supposed to dilute it with water. Common sense. My goodness.
Although some people do take their Milo straight from the tin.
Yes, that was another reason I was an obese child.
Don't even mention condensed
milk. Oh, yes. Yeah, so they add sugar to the Milo and then condensed milk. And then they're like, oh my God, Milo is bad for me. Wake up, la.
That's a clarion call. Yeah. You know, it's interesting you also mentioned the energy bar, because of how they market it and how you would say at the front label in this huge bubble box, it says 12 grams of protein. When you read the label behind the packaging, it's actually 12 grams of protein per serving, but also 35 grams of carbohydrates, mostly sugar.
Yes,
so,
exactly.
You know, if you want 12 grams of protein, you might as well eat 2 eggs.
Yeah.
You'll get your 12 grams of protein.
Yeah.
But speaking of energy, Milo, for us growing up, I think in the 80s, you would remember the tagline of Milo being Sehat dan Kuat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's now not allowed.
Yes, that's right. And but I think our memories are still stuck in the past.
Of course.
And that's why we have this assumption that Milo is a healthy drink.
Yeah.
Of course, now they go on the energy tagline, and it's now energy to go further. In the same way, I suppose you could make the assumption that, yes, this provides children with energy for activities. If you are a savvy consumer like Juliet is, you read the nutrition label, you figure out you want to balance the amount of sugar with the amount of protein that your child could be getting, whether it's fortified with enough vitamins and minerals, whether it could be sort of supplementing your child's diet if the child doesn't like to drink milk, let's say, right? So you just have to balance. You know your child's eating habits best. I don't understand the way people look at products singularly or even nutrients singularly, mm-hmm. and yep. pinpoint that either as a savior or a villain. We don't eat one nutrient, we don't eat one food product, we eat a lot of things, so it's all about the balance
and in combination of everything. I think it's a more actually their tagline, energy to go further, it's more accurate in terms of how the drink is consumed. It is about providing energy. If you're going to have a sedentary lifestyle and you drink Milo 3 times a day, then well, you're really messing with your own body. But if you have sports to play, or the kids, right, they need energy for their co-curricular activities and so on, and a glass of Milo might not be excessive at all.
Yeah. And Malaysian children, I think, notoriously have poor breakfast habits.
Yeah.
Because school starts so early for morning session kids, they don't have time to eat breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask me, I think Milo is a good thing to start the day with, or if you feel that it's too sweet, don't use so much of it. Top it up with milk. And then make sure that you eat the two eggs, right? Like, right. Like Tina said.
And a banana, or a fruit, an apple.
It's really about making an effort and getting kids to get into that habit.
Yeah. Anyway, speaking of nutrition labels, anyone has a suggestion on how we are actually supposed to read them?
It's a very complex thing, the nutrition label.
That's why I'm leaving it to you
to be fair, it's not easy to understand it. If you see the listing, 40% of sugar, sometimes I can't blame people for jumping to conclusions. So what actually is in the nutrition label? You have the nutritional information table, which will list out the main nutrients and some optional other nutrients. The main nutrients that must be declared are energy, carbohydrate, protein, and fat. That applies to all food products. And for ready-to-drink beverages, total sugars must also be declared. And then you have the optional nutrients like vitamins, minerals, fiber, fatty acids. Some products like to declare their cholesterol amount as well. And so let's say for vitamins and minerals, they must be present in significant amounts before they can be listed on the label. So you can't just put a drop in there and then claim to be, you know, 45.
0.002 micrograms.
That's right. And the label will also contain a list of ingredients. Now, that's important as well. To look at what's actually going into your, let's say, box of cereals, the ingredients are listed in their amount that they contain. So the first few ingredients will be higher in amount, and then it goes down in descending order. So I noticed Tina Camellia has a tin of butter biscuits on her table.
It was a Chinese New Year gift from the hampers.
Not judging. But if you look at the ingredients, margarine is listed first.
No, it was second. Wheat flour was the first.
Yes.
So that's the highest. Margarine.
Before butter comes.
I think butter was fifth on the list.
Yes. So that shows you that there's more margarine than butter.
So it's false advertising. It's not butter cookies. It's margarine cookies.
Okay, so who's to blame for that then? You know, who is the one who is in charge of making sure that you're not doing false advertising, for example? Does this fall under the Ministry of Health's jurisdiction or?
It does. The Food Safety and Quality Division. Mm-hmm. Well, they operate under the Food Act and regulations. So that's where all these provisions are stipulated, how you list your ingredients. Like when I mentioned earlier, what must be present in significant amounts, it's all out there for manufacturers to follow. And of course, when it comes to products that are actually in the market that don't follow the law, mm-hmm. well, that comes down to enforcement, doesn't it?
Like
whether maybe consumers could complain and say that I feel like I'm being deceived by this product. The laws are there. It's a question of how savvy are consumers to look at these things and to sort of stand up and say, okay, I don't think this is right. And when that happens, the question is, like with Milo, a lot of people getting so angry. I feel like you could just choose to drink less.
Or not
drink it at all if you feel that it's not right for your diet and your lifestyle.
I've not had a glass of Milo in a while anyway. Grown up now.
I don't want us to sound like we are championing Milo or anything like that. It's not that we're not being paid by Nestle. It's just that use your common sense as consumers, you know, wherever possible, read the nutrition label about what you are consuming and what you're putting into your children's mouths. You know, that is the logical thing to do. That's all
yes.
I'm saying.
Take control of your own diet and nutrition and not put the burden on the manufacturers, on the suppliers, on the government to... What, do you want us to be in a nanny state mm-hmm. where, mm-hmm. you know, everything is decided for you? You have to make your own decisions about your health and your feeding behavior and so on, right? And tomorrow morning when you have your breakfast, go read your cereal box while you're at it.
It will be enlightening, let me assure you.
It is very interesting. I don't have cereals.
Mm. Yeah. Good old-fashioned oats will do the trick, actually.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fresh fruit and, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's not tasty. Why?
No, they are.
That's a completely different story.
I think
over
we've
there.
Just been conditioned to think that things that are colorful and sweet are tasty.
Yeah, so, exactly.
All right. So I think the conclusion is be a wiser consumer.
Yep.
That's
the
fine print.
Yes.
All right. We're going to have a quick break for a glass of hot beverage that may or may not be a malt drink. And when we come back, we're going to talk about doulas. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
The Health News Digest on the Bigger Picture. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest. I'm Tina Camila in the studio with me, Tisha Ik and Juliet Jacobs. Earlier, we were talking about how you should read your nutrition labels. And now we're moving on to the next story about doulas.
Yes, so recently in Johor, a baby died during a home birth after it was born in a breech position and the baby's head was actually stuck in the mother's perineum and could not breathe. The mother was allegedly assisted by a doula in this home birth. And doulas are actually, I'm not sure if either of you are familiar with this term, they are birth companions or birth coaches. And they're actually supposed to serve as, to provide emotional support for mothers. It could be in a hospital setting. Doulas are accepted in some hospitals as well. What they are not meant to do is to actually assist in delivery, because that comes under the purview of skilled health personnel like doctors and midwives. And home births are actually becoming a bit of a trend now, where mothers choose to deliver at home, where they feel like they want to return to the natural and gentle form of childbirth. I personally have I'm very against this idea of home births because it's a romanticized notion. Yes, we want to have as natural birth as possible, but medical advances have given us the privilege of technologies that can help us to be safe. They can protect us and our baby, and in case of any emergencies, which is very, very prevalent.
So you both mothers, you both had hospital births?
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
Right. But mine was considered a high-risk pregnancy. So even if I had aspirations of having a home birth or a water birth or whatever, my doctor was, you know, she said, no. Not that I wanted to, because I knew I was high-risk. And yes, because of that, yeah, I would not put myself in that position.
Yeah, I think the thing about birth trends today is also that with so much better nutrition and with so much more contact with your doctor throughout your whole pregnancy period, babies are actually so much bigger than they were two generations ago. Mm-hmm. And the birth canal, we are not evolving at the same rate mm-hmm. as the growth of the baby in the womb. Mm-hmm. So it is more and more difficult for you to have the birth through your birth canal. And that makes home births a lot more riskier.
Yes.
Because you would have no medical intervention close to you if anything goes wrong.
On the Health and Living show, we interviewed consultant obstetrician anesthesiologist Prof. YK Chan in January this year, where she explained the dangers of home births.
Currently, the statistics show that something like 10,000 mothers deliver at home. They don't realise that up to 15% of home births can actually turn into trouble deliveries itself. And one of the most common complications of this kind of deliveries is hemorrhage, because after the baby is delivered, if the uterus doesn't contract, then they can bleed. And if they are away at home without proper arrangements for blood to be given when they need it, then even a matter of about 5 to 10 minutes journey can be fatal for them. Now, even if you look at 15% of that population getting into trouble, 15% is actually a very high figure. It means that 15 out of 100 of the mothers will get into trouble, not from hemorrhage itself, but from other causes as well, other problems as well. 85% can get scot-free, but that's the population risk. But when you're talking about yourself, it's either going to be 0%, no trouble, or 100% of trouble.
So when she talks about that 5 to 10 minutes delay, I've actually read a lot of home birth advocates online saying that, I chose to have my baby at home and I live only 10 minutes away from the hospital, so it would have been no problem to rush to the hospital if anything had gone wrong. But as Prof. Chan explains, 10 minutes could be, you know, far too long.
Yeah, and you might not have people standing by knowing that there's a mother 10 minutes away
yes.
giving birth at home.
Yes.
You would still have to go through the emergency
system,
doors
yes,
and,
that's right.
and triage you and so
that's
on.
Right, because yeah, yeah. you don't know what the problem is. You need
exactly.
to assess the whole situation.
Yeah.
And you're burdening the hospital system unnecessarily.
Correct. I mean, one of the stories that I still remember, this was maybe about 5 years ago, where a very high-profile home birth coach, she had her sixth child at home. So her first two babies were born in the hospital through cesarean section and her last four at home. And she died during her sixth. So she left her six kids motherless. They're all under nine at the time.
Absolutely tragic.
Yeah, it is very sad. But I guess, you know, I understand why some women want to do it. I know of a person who went to the hospital and had her first child there. And because, again, there was some complication and they used... And the doctor did not allow the baby to come out or wasn't there and the nurses were doing it. And the baby's head got stuck again in the birth canal. And we can't prove if there's a correlation, but that child did end up having some brain damage and was forever, for the rest of her life. She unfortunately died at the age of 17. But for those 17 years, she was... mentally retarded. She could not walk. She was mentally retarded. I don't know what other word to use for that. I guess the argument being made is also that things can go wrong in the hospital as well. But I also can understand the argument there is at least you've got people who can care for it immediately. But I feel bad saying that we cannot have that choice, I suppose. I can imagine some mothers getting very angry with us saying that you have to have your you have to have your babies in the hospital because there are complications that can happen there as well.
Yeah. Well, of course, but at least you have someone to blame.
Yeah. you do. And then, but then it also comes that whole horrible process of, you know, lawsuits, which can drag on for like...
For sure.
Yeah, you know, so there's things can go wrong anyway.
It's true, yeah. Yeah, I mean, deaths or injuries could happen in the hospital or at home. But I feel that it is a lot more manageable in a hospital setting than it is at home.
Definitely.
The chances of things going wrong... At home.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Not just to the baby, right? To yourself
exactly.
as well. I mean, like, look what happened to Serena Williams. She was in a hospital, high profile as she is. Mm-hmm. She had to tell the people what was wrong with her. I mean, even in that situation, you know, the hospital would not listen to her and she had to, you know, fight for her right to be heard. So,
yeah. I mean, I acknowledge, I'm sure there are many, many weaknesses in the hospital system that need to be improved to look at. The mother, the family, holistically. I think depression is something that postpartum depression is something that's often not assessed for and picked up in the hospital setting as well. That's why so many mothers go undiagnosed. Deaths do happen in the hospital as well, but let's see how Prof Chan puts it into perspective.
25 out of 100,000 deliveries end up with maternal deaths. But if you're looking at home deliveries, figures of about 70 to 90 mothers dying for every 100,000 deliveries at home. So it's probably something like 3 to 4 times higher if you deliver at home, maternal death, compared to in the hospital setting.
So mathematically or statistically speaking, the risk of getting yourself in trouble at home is a lot higher.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, patients' rights is something that's being advocated very strongly now.
Oh, yes.
So, like you've said, Juliet, mothers do have real concerns about giving birth. They have the fear of the pain. Many don't want epidurals. They don't want episiotomies because of the any lasting effects from that. And they feel that the hospital setting is a very cold and foreign environment to welcome a baby into. I mean, all those are very, very valid concerns and should be discussed with the obstetricians. Prof Chan, in that interview, she did mention that many hospitals are now open for you to make the delivery room as comforting for yourself as possible. You know, ask to be able to bring in your pillows, your aromatherapy candles, have people there to you know, whether it's your husband or your partner or sibling, perhaps somebody you really want to be there with you during the delivery. She says that these are the kinds of factors that need to be taken into account. I feel that whatever it is, women need to know the risks before they make their decisions. They need to know about, you know, whether their medical history is predisposing them to a low-risk or high-risk pregnancy. Are they able to get to a hospital in case of an emergency? And what kind of situation would constitute an emergency? Many women are taken in by the idea of home birth without knowing about the risk. They only read about the rosy parts of it. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, the fine print would be know your risks.
Yep, I agree. No arguments there. I think it is also a challenge for the hospital, at least the maternity ward, to improve on their services and provide a more holistic one than, you know, just mother in, baby out.
Yeah, that's right.
And that is what the delivery room is, right? It's a very sterile, it's... I remember,
factory-like.
Yes, it is. It's really quite an awful room. And yes, you just pop your baby out and then you're out. And then you're pushed back into the ward, you know. So there's nothing comforting in there. Luckily, I was high on drugs, so it was all right. But, you know, the point is it's not warm. Yeah. It's not welcoming.
And the staff are... The staff are there to do their jobs, which is, like you said, baby out, you know, they're monitoring our vitals and they're...
And they've got a job to do, yeah.
Yes. In my situation, I had a C-section. And for me, the best person in the room was actually the anesthesiologist. He held my hand. He talked me through what was happening because there's a screen up so that you can't see what's going on, fortunately. but he sort of, you know, just... took me through the process, explained what the obstetrician doing right now. So he was my pillar of support.
He was your doula.
He was my doula. And I think that, we shouldn't discount the role, or medical professionals themselves shouldn't discount the role that they can play, which wouldn't take too much out of their day-to-day routine.
And just to give full credit to my gynecologist, she was the best. She talked me through it. She was comforting. You know, my husband was making horrible faces there. You know, like, what's going on? This is the comfort that I had from my spouse. But Dr. Pramitha was so kind, so warm, so, you know, just made the whole process so easy. So, yes, exactly. It was such a breeze thanks to her.
Mm. Yeah, so I think medical doctors or medical professionals, they can make a difference depending on how much effort they want to put in their, you know. Yeah. Well, I guess the fine print was, again,
know your risk.
Thank you. All right. So when we come back, we'll talk about a blood test for Alzheimer's. That's the lyrics from Landslide by Fleetwood Mac. A tease about our final story of the hour. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
I took my love, took it down. I climbed a mountain and I turned around. And I saw my reflection in snow-covered hills till the landslide brought me down. Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love? Can the child within my heart rise above? Can I sail through the changing ocean tides? Can I handle the seasons of my life? Well, I've been afraid of changing, 'cause I've built my life around you. But time made you bolder, even children get older, and I'm getting older too. Too. Oh, I'm getting older too. And if you see my reflection in the snow-covered hills, where the landslide bring it down. And if you see my reflection in the snow-covered hills, where the landslide bring it down.
The Health News Digest on the Bigger Picture. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest. I'm Tina Camilla. Also in the studio with me, Julia Jacobs and T. Xiao Ik. Today's theme is reading the fine print. And we've been talking about Milo and doulas. And now, Alzheimer's blood test. Scientists in Japan and Australia have developed a blood test that can detect the buildup of toxic proteins linked to Alzheimer's disease. And Juliet's very keen on taking this test.
Yes, I am. Only because someone who I know, very, very close family member, is suffering from Alzheimer's. And it is one of the most tragic things that I'm having to witness, to see somebody who was so strong, so articulate, so powerful, now reduced to, and I use the word reduced, but you know, now who can barely even string sentence together. And this is somebody who was, like I said, very intelligent, you know, a very strong person, you know, reduced to that. And it's heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking to see. And there were signs, I suppose, in hindsight, always you can see the signs, right? But now there's nothing can be done because we've reached a certain stage, for example, right? So for me, this test was like, oh, if I can at least pinpoint it, like, yes, that I could have the potential for that. Maybe just to put things in place to make that process easier. There's no cure. I know that there's no cure, but I can at least myself, you know, put things in place before I get to a stage where I can't even, you know, remember my son's name. That's why I got very excited when I saw it. Because, you know, you never think you're going to get it, right?
Of course.
Yeah, so that's the thing, love.
Well, just to explain how this test works. So
she's got bad news for you.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, read fine
print. I was the one very excited about it. I remember, yeah, guys, test!
So we dug into it. The test looks for a toxic protein in the brain called amyloid beta. And this protein builds up in the brain during the course of the disease. And by assessing the ratios of the types of amyloid fragment in the brain, the researchers found that they were able to accurately predict its levels. And I suppose scientifically, academically, it's exciting because it shows that it's possible to, you know, test blood to see what's happening in the brain. And of course, with a disease like Alzheimer's, where there's always the question of, can we reverse or slow down the progression or of the damage in the brain? And so little is known about how it actually causes changes to the brain. Any sort of progress is always welcome.
Sure, but we had Dr. Azina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist, only just this month to talk about DNA 101. And she was talking about how our genetics dictate the kind of proteins that we produce. And, I mean, she had some reservations about tests like this in general.
We would read headlines, let's say, the gene for Alzheimer's disease has been found. Now, what does that mean?
Yeah, well, that I have a special problem with that. Because actually when they say the gene for, you know, Alzheimer's disease has been found, I mean, in one way, they are accurate, but it's not to say that people who have Alzheimer's disease have a special extra gene that we don't have. We all have that gene, right? So, for example, one of the most common genes that is implicated in risk of developing Alzheimer's is a gene called apolipoprotein E or ApoE gene. Everybody has the ApoE gene. It's just different forms of that gene. DNA is the hereditary material that stays in the nucleus that is in our cell. And so RNA is a kind of messenger that is read from the DNA code and is an intermediary between the DNA and proteins. So proteins are made from the RNA product, and they may not really look at your whole lifestyle to be able to really give you an accurate
prediction of your risk for disease. And when you get back that report, how do you interpret it? Because a lot of the time they just send you the report and then they're like, 40% risk of, heart disease. And what does that really mean,
correct.
And from our own research, looking at Parkinson's disease, you also need to be a little bit careful because a lot of their kits or their assays, for example, have been developed using data that has come out from the Caucasian population, right? So the Asian population may have some slight differences. So we know, for example, in a gene that we're working on called the LRRK2 gene or LRRK2 gene, which has a number of different mutations on it, the most common mutation in Caucasians is absent in the Chinese and also Malays and to most part Indians. So if I was a, say, Malay person and I send my DNA off for this particular test for Parkinson's disease risk, right, and it will come back negative, but it's actually because they've looked at the wrong one, It's not one that is relevant to me. So that's where a lot of these testing companies, sometimes they push too early, before there's enough sort of scientific basis behind it. And that kind of confuses the public.
Yeah. So you're right, Shaoyi, that any progress is important, especially when we're dealing with something that is so, I guess, crippling.
It is.
Right? It is such a...
I guess the issue is that there's no good news as of now, as far as I know. Good news when it comes to Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. Nothing, right? So even that's, I guess, why I got so excited and I took the clickbait. I was like, at least... Because, sometimes they say, maybe it's hereditary. And then I look at, the close family members who I'm related to, the patient, and I'm like... Maybe we can start doing something, drink more coconut oil, do all those kind of you'll do anything, I suppose. You'll do anything at that point just to kind of stem it or just to prepare for it.
And the process of diagnosing Alzheimer's is so complex as well,
yes.
isn't it?
Because you have to eliminate all the other possibilities, right?
Correct, yes. There are many possible conditions that can cause dementia or dementia-like behavior. So with there being no straightforward test, doctors have to take a full patient history, family history, medical history. They have to do all sorts of neurological tests to assess, your balance and your vision and all these cognitive functions. They have to assess your mental functions through neuropsychological tests. And then there's a whole host of all these other assessments to rule out the other causes of dementia, which could include strokes and tumors and psychiatric conditions as well.
Yeah, I guess an argument would be like, why bother taking a test? Because once you get it, you're going to just get it anyway, right? There's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
But as a caregiver, it would help me a lot, I think, because I could prepare. I wouldn't be just slapped in the face with this diagnosis and then suddenly have to scramble and sort out all the caregiving that is necessary. And a lot of caregiving is necessary. So if this test were ever to become an effective one, I would still take that blood test and, prepare myself or my family or whoever it is that needs to be prepared and put in plans to face the inevitable as it is.
Would you say the same for things like the BRCA test for breast cancer or...
Yeah.
So this is a blanket statement for all forms of... Because I have some issues about that as well. And I've mentioned that on air before and I received some listener feedback about it because it is...
Irresponsible?
Yes, it is a little bit irresponsible to say that I would rather not know. That's a personal...
decision.
Yes,
for sure.
It is. But I also understand, from your perspective, Juliet, because you are dealing with it on a day-to-day basis and this could possibly be your future, right? This could be you and this could be the burden that your offsprings are going to have to bear.
Exactly.
At this rate where we don't have a cure. We're nowhere near, finding a cure for Alzheimer's or most neurodegenerative diseases, right? So... I get it.
Can I just say that I was exactly like you? For me, it was like, if I get it, right? But now I'm thinking on the side of a caregiver. What if the person that I love so much is the person who's going to get that? I want to be prepared so that I put in whatever it is, savings or, look for the right people who can assist me when the time comes, just to have that kind of planning so that, your loved one also gets the correct care and at the same time, you are prepared so you get the correct care for yourself. We all know about caregiver fatigue and the stresses that come with that. So it's all just about prepping, just knowing. I'm in a very prepping mood these days,
Well, it makes sense. I think my thing was that
I don't want to be burdened by a possibility. You know, for example, this test could come back as, let's say, 60% chance of getting it. Mm-hmm. What does that really mean? I don't know. It means nothing.
And within how many years? And how many of those years do you spend sort of waiting for the symptoms to appear?
Yeah. That's right.
How does it affect your life and your family?
Yeah, if the test comes back, say, 97%, it's almost very likely. Mm. But if it's at 63%?
So I guess I would again say, I would force myself then, if I have a 60% chance or my loved one has a 60% chance, I will force myself to read up everything I can about it now so that I know. So when in the case of the person that my loved one who now is suffering from Alzheimer's, nobody knew anything. All the reading started after, and the poor patient had to endure months of being misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And being treated callously, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And looking back, that's a very, very painful thing to say, like, oh my God, we didn't understand and we didn't treat you well, you know? We didn't treat you as you should have been treated. Mm-hmm. So again, it's I would arm myself with all the knowledge I can. So if somebody I know is getting breast cancer, for example, I would want to know what I need to do to make that person, And if I were to do it, I would force my poor only offspring to realize what's going to happen, you know, so just to arm yourself with knowledge. All I'm saying is arm yourself with knowledge. That's the point of these tests to me.
If it's 10% and you're that 10%.
I would still read up. I would just read up. I mean, just to understand. And
the
not
genetic
to be...
lottery is harsh.
Oh,
let
yes,
me tell you that.
Yeah.
You can have a 10% and you are that 10%.
You are, yes, absolutely. Yeah. You're a statistical anomaly.
What a downer to
what
end
on, you know.
Okay, no. Let me make it a little bit more comforting. Mm-hmm. We will have an event this year in April. We are talking about future-focused healthcare. We're talking about your patients' rights, the costs in healthcare that could come with potentially getting Alzheimer's and so on. Mm-hmm. We're talking about growing old gracefully and
happily.
Happily and healthily.
And you're right to do that. You know, it's not that because you're old, you deserve to just die.
Exactly.
Or you're called a goomer.
So, yes. Please do look forward to the event. Our registration starts next week. Meera Sivasodhi is going to be there. Dr. George Lee is going to be there. Patrick Teo is our host. Mm-hmm. And we have a lineup of some of the best speakers in the fields.
Yeah. All under one roof, just for you. No long consultation hours, no having to make appointments. Just come and just listen and be amazed.
That's right. April 7th, Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. So that's the fine print. The fine print is register for our event to know all the answers to all of the questions that we have asked.
Yeah, that works.
That's all we have this hour. This has been Health News Digest. If you missed any part of the show, you can always download the podcast from our BFM app, available on Google Play and the Apple App Store. I'm Tina Camellia.
I'm Tisha E.
And I'm Juliet Jacobs.
This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.